We're busy people. We got places to be. So many places. However many places we need to get away from dealing with our problems, that's how many places we got. We are not at risk for not having enough places. When we were kids, we used to twist up our faces in defiance each morning because we had to go to school. But school was a place. Training grounds for the rat race in which they taught us to chase down a living, even though that meant giving up our best years so we could save enough money to enjoy our worst. Even though that meant backburnering our own ambitions so we could toe the company line first, but work was a place. And in it, our days became a routine where we learned to trace around the edges of whatever life we wanted. We were told we could have it all. But our skulls became houses haunted with the stress of job security. We found ourselves at the mercy of an ever-changing world. Fingers curled around the oh shit handles, we started to pick up speed. Our veins became a hallway of time through which we began to bleed the same old day in, day out. Devout in our duties, but always with our eyes on the clock, we would watch the minute hand shake hands with the hour hand. Our dreams became castles being built in the sand of an hourglass where time kept slipping away. We became cheerleaders, rooting on the end of the day. We couldn't wait to go home, because home was the place. Our base of operations where we drafted up battle plans for the future. We had plans for all those many years ahead. But mostly, we just saddled up our bed and rode it into sleep because we had to be up to do it all over again the next morning. In the midst of our dreams, we heard our alarm clock shout their warning into our weary bodies that soon we would again have to leave our homes so we could keep our homes. Our enthusiasm for this life was left behind to wander through the catacombs of all the things we could have been, all the places we could have ended up. We have so many places, not just the cradle, not just the grave, but all the places in between. Places where we traded away our time to become cogs in a machine that's been breaking down for decades. There are parades of the rejected walking the streets every day. They sit like missing parts beside a machine that has no place for them. Places for the corrupt. Places for the treacherous, the untrustworthy. We have places made of steel-reinforced concrete 3.5 feet thick to protect money that will go to building more places that will sit empty. But we have no place for society's most downtrodden. We watch their horizons diminish while our skylines broaden and our cities grow. How is it that with all this growth, there remains no place for the abandoned or the destitute? Their daily commute from desperation to hope gets longer the more numb we become to the fact that these are people. And like Sisyphus, we push change up a steep hill, only to watch it roll back down to the bottom after getting so close to the top. Bureaucracy holds up a stop sign to our compassion and says, nothing can be done. It's the same spin that's been spun ever since they loaded apathy into a gun that sits unlocked in a cabinet of despair. Where can they go? No sleeping on the street. No resting on bus benches. Unwanted everywhere they go. They dig trenches deeper into themselves because there is a war being waged upon them. Not with artillery. Who needs all those explosions of noise when you've got something as quiet and as deadly as red tape? There are holes in the safety net in the shape of people. We forget tragedy is a switch. We're never more than one flick away from the it that can happen to anyone at any time. The climb back to sure footing isn't always as easy as putting your best foot forward. Isn't easy to look for a way out when your vision is blurred by tears born from the labor of having to accept society doesn't want you. How is anyone meant to keep going knowing that no one cares? Anyone who wears the scar of homelessness knows that in this world there exist avenues of disaster with losses so profound they can envelop you. For some, it becomes a syringe. Each hinge on the doorway leading out of addiction slowly rusting shut. For others, it's a sharpened economy, ready to cut loose anyone who falls behind on rent, even if this time it was spent on training men to lift them out of poverty. Or maybe it was a bank who said they were doing you a favor by lending you money, when really they were just betting against you. Maybe disaster blew away your home. Maybe you were left to roam the waiting room of your insurance company whose policy is to deny claim or delay payment because every cent they can keep in the bank is another turn on the crank of a machine that spits out compound interest, which means there's money to be made by keeping your future on a waiting list. Indifference has taken the place of mercy. When we need action, we distract ourselves with whatever new controversy is handed to us. Diversion has taken the place of focus. And while we sink deeper into an abyss of lassitude, the cord that connects us to our humanity is being chewed through by greedy teeth. Our detachment is being twisted into a wreath, being laid upon the headstone of our tenacity. We used to fight for one another. But hey, we're busy people. We got places to be. We got so many places. However many places we need to hide our faces from the people who have nothing and who we have to walk by on our way to whatever place we have to be, that's how many places we got. We are not at risk for not having enough places. Places for the indifferent, places for the greedy, but no place for the abandoned, no place for the strange, no place for anyone begging us for change.
Good morning, Nexus. I hope you enjoyed that piece by Shane as much as I did. I'll later touch on why poems, songs, and stories are essential in bringing us together in something Willie Jennings calls the spectacular joining. We'll also hear about a story of disciples who mysteriously escaped from prison and about the man who thought he was being wise and helpful by sitting on the sidelines. But first, I want to follow up on Shane Coyson's poem with some thoughts about place. Of all the Nexus practices, as much as I see value in each of them, the one that has really connected with me is presence and place. For me, place has been at the core of what Nexus is all about, even from its inception when it was decided to locate in downtown Kitchener. And this concept of place really is fascinating to me. I think about my memories and how many of them are tied to a specific location. Sometimes the details of that place in my memory are a little bit foggy, but so often it's a key component of my memories, whether it's my childhood home, a favorite place to hang out with friends, or when and where I first met some of the important people in my life. Place is at the center of it all. And I think that's because place is really about stories and connection. Now, ever since I was a kid, I have loved maps, which is kind of ironic because I really struggle with direction and space on a map. But that's okay, because the reason I love maps is for the names of the villages, towns, and cities. Some of them are so fascinating, and of course, many are rather humorous. I'm sure many of us have chuckled about some of the names of communities, such as Intercourse, Pennsylvania, or Shag Harbor, Nova Scotia. Of course, Dildo Newfoundland made the news in 2019 when TV show host Jimmy Kimmel first heard of it. The locals had a great time with the media interest, even making Kimmel their honorary mayor. So of course, when Todd and I visited my brother in Newfoundland that year, we had to pop by for a quick visit. But many people are passionately connected to building and place names. I mean, that discussion is at the fore lately as many communities consider renaming schools and streets. It's not often that a whole town would change its name, but that's what happened recently in Quebec. A mining town, long known for its production of a once often used construction material, voted to change their name to Val-de-Source this past October. The town's previous name, of course, was Asbestos. As concerns around the safety of asbestos rose, with several studies linking it to cancer and other diseases, the town voted to rename itself, which I think highlights how place and names are really about connection. Of course, many of the names we now use for communities and landmarks are not the original names of those places. What we now know as the Grand River was first named Willow River, or Oseganu-Hadaje. If that name sounds familiar to you, it's because that is the name of the land back camp that resided in now named Victoria Park last year. While Val-de-Source, Quebec, voted to shed their connection to the name Asbestos, We know that many Indigenous names have been lost due to colonization. We know, too, that many people who were enslaved and brought to North America were given new names. If we understand that names and stories connect us to people and places, what does that mean for people who had that connection taken from them? Malcolm X says this: "The real names of our people were destroyed during slavery. The last name of my forefathers was taken from them when they were brought to America and made slaves. And then the name of the slave master was given, which we refuse. We reject that name today and refuse it. I never acknowledge it whatsoever." I think I find this idea of place so interesting because it does serve as a connection point, which reminds me of a lovely little parquet in the city at the corner of Queen and Weber. In this little green space, you'll find an art installation by local artist Ernest Detweiler. This installation is called Past, Present, Future, and I just love it. Let me just take a quick moment to share a little bit about this space. Three of the spheres are limestone, which the artist says refers to our distant past. The large sphere is made of bricks taken from some old downtown Kitchener buildings, referencing our more recent past. The present is represented by a reflective steel sphere, which always reminded me of M.C. Escher's hand with reflecting sphere. And the last two spheres are elevated by two posts and represent the future. I've always loved that when you look into the one for the present, you are able to see the spheres representing the past and the future. I've also wondered if it was intentional to have this installation so close to the Kitchener Public Library, a place that is very much a connection point. For me, the library is an embodiment of the past, present, and future that this artist is depicting. Also, just a cool fact about this piece as well, is that through a partnership between the region and the Grand Valley Institution, women from the prison landscape the area around the art and are adding gardens and Indigenous plants. And of course, just behind this park is the original county jail and governor's house, and I'm sure Todd could give you lots more details about the history of that space. And actually, speaking of prison reminds me that this idea of place is not only about geography and physical space, but also about relationships. We can't truly understand place without also looking at power and access. So what does place mean when we consider the prison system? Think of the Grand Valley Institution as just one example. It is the only federal women's prison in Ontario, but what do we actually know about it? For me, not very much. In 2019, I attended a performance of Guarded Girls at the Registry Theatre. Remember being able to go to live theatre? The play depicted the experience of inmates of the Grand Valley Institution. I walked out of that performance speechless. It was extremely powerful and a reminder that many of us don't have a very deep understanding of the prison system in our country, even though we have a federal prison right in our city. There's much more to say about prisons, power, and place. In 2 weeks, Kimberly Walker will explore the roles of prison in the Book of Acts. For today, though, I again want to ask what place means when we consider the prison system and how Acts might shine a light on that for us. Jennings claims that only when we follow the angel of the Lord into those spaces of captivity will we see what has been hidden from us, a system that kills, steals, and destroys lives while claiming to keep order and protect the innocent. Now, all of this, finally, brings me to the story in Acts that I want to share today. But first, a little context. This story is found in Acts 5, right after the story of Ananias and Sapphira that John shared 2 weeks ago. The apostles are speaking publicly and converting folks in great numbers. The Sanhedrin, which essentially is a council of elders, and the high priest are not happy about this at all, so they throw the apostles in jail. The next day, the high priest calls for the apostles, but they're nowhere to be found. An angel of the Lord came in the night and released them. Of course, the high priest and council won't stand for that. They send out the temple police to find the missing apostles. Eventually, they are found and brought to this council. The council, who wants to kill the apostles, must decide on their plan. So we already see these issues of power at play and how those in power solve problems by having unwanted or problem people incarcerated. Here's what happens next. When the council heard this, they were furious and wanted to put the apostles to death. But a Pharisee named Gamaliel, a teacher of the law, who was honored by all the people, stood up in the Sanhedrin and ordered that the men be put outside for a little while. Then he addressed the Sanhedrin, "Men of Israel, consider carefully what you intend to do with these men. Some time ago, Theudas appeared, claiming to be somebody, and about 400 men rallied to him. He was killed, all of his followers were dispersed, and it all came to nothing. After him, Judas the Galilean appeared in the days of the census and led a band of people in revolt. He too was killed, and his followers were scattered. Therefore, in the present case, I advise you, leave these men alone, let them go. For if their purpose or activity is of human origin, it will fail. But if it is from God, you will not be able to stop these men. You will only find yourselves fighting against God." Awesome. Gamaliel solves this challenging problem of what to do with his disciples. Just let the whole thing play out. If it's a God thing, we have no chance of fighting against it. And if it's not, well, it will just die out. As I read the story, I thought, way to go, Gamaliel. That seems like a balanced and wise approach. But after doing some more reading on this, I realized it was not so wise after all. This is what Willie Jennings has to say. The frightful reality at the heart of his words is that they reflect a properly formed and supremely trained scholar who, like many others, cannot see the divine visitation because it has come as unimpressive flesh. It has come in the common. The exceptional in society look for their own, the exceptional. God must appear in the exceptional to appear as God to this Pharisee. Ouch! Jennings is saying that the religious leaders of the day can't see God acting right in front of them because they expect him to appear and act in exceptional ways, not as unimpressive flesh. If I'm honest with myself, I suspect that I may do the same as Gamaliel and his peers. Jennings says that Gamaliel reads history from the wrong side. When reading of events in the past, it sometimes feels so easy to identify those who were on the wrong side of history. But what about for us right now? Have you ever wondered if you might be on the wrong side of history on an issue currently? This is a thought I have often wondered myself. It reminds me of a quotation I read from a former QAnon follower who said that the problem with conspiracy theories is that they feel like critical thinking. According to Jennings, Gamaliel's fault in this story is that he was looking for his own. And I can't help but wonder if this is why so many of us don't have a good understanding of the history and current experiences of the poor, marginalized, and vulnerable. How often does something only start to gain political traction or change once it impacts us in some way? A few examples come to mind for me. The first is the affordable housing crisis. Housing is becoming increasingly unaffordable for many in this region. And locally, we're starting to see some real efforts on this. However, this is not a new issue. There are many in our community for whom access to housing has long been a challenge, if not impossible. Yet it seems to be making far more news now that this is an issue also for the middle class. Another example comes from The Ripper on Netflix, which tells the story of a serial killer in 1970s England. Many of the victims of these crimes were, as the police stated, just prostitutes, and the documentary suggested that because of that, police did not put full efforts into solving these crimes until an innocent woman was murdered. And lastly, we have seen great efforts and funding over the last year developing and distributing COVID vaccines. However, there are still many diseases that mostly impact poorer countries, and if the same efforts and funding were put into them, it's likely vaccines for these diseases could also be developed. Jennings says that Gamaliel is an example of a compromised intellectual whose politics always end in observation from a safe distance. That one hurts in its accuracy. What I first thought was a wise and balanced approach is perhaps the exact kind of action that results in the status quo. Jennings continues by stating that Gamaliel cannot hear God calling them to come and join the movement. What are we being called to? And are we missing out on those calls? As many of you know, I'm very excited in local politics. So to be honest, when I see a call to join the movement, I kind of get excited. I think, yes, let's rally the citizens to take action on issues they are passionate about. Such as when we saw thousands of residents walk locally on June 3rd last year in the Solidarity March for Black Lives. Taking to the streets in protest is one example how place is essential to creating change in our communities. And I think there is real value in joining these kinds of movements. But I'm not convinced that's what Willie Jennings means here. I wonder if the movement we are called to revolves around storytelling. Jennings says, "There is no more powerful embodied reality in the world than a storyteller. They conjure reality, capturing in word and sound, in song and deeds, in pictures and diverse renderings, past, present, and future. Give me storytellers, and I will rule the world. Indeed, all worldly power begins in storytelling and reaches its greatest leverage in storytelling." That really rings true for me. Jennings sees storytellers representing the past, present, and future, much like Detweiler's art installation. It brings us back to this point of place and stories serving as connection. When I think about the ways I best understand this world, it's through the work of storytellers. That might be through spoken word artists like Shane Coyson in the piece that we heard at the beginning of today's message, or Indigenous stories represented through art, like the art of Leah Dorian, who worked with the University of Alberta's Native Studies faculty to create a series of paintings that share some of the stories of Indigenous history. At Nexus, our Sunday morning messages are all about stories, or even in the stories shared between friends over food and drinks, something I think even the most introverted folks like me are looking forward to doing eventually. Jennings says that as followers of Jesus, we are called into the spectacular joining. He claims, "Now these followers of Jesus will become the bridge between uneven wealth and resources, uneven hope, and uneven life." I love this idea of a spectacular joining as a bridge, and it really brings me back to that idea about connection. What serves as a better image of a connection than a bridge? I mean, the whole point of a bridge is to connect two previously unconnected places. Bridges are an extremely common piece of infrastructure for us, so much so that we likely don't give them much thought. But take a moment to think about some of the bridges that you've crossed in your life. Being so close to the Grand River, we know the importance bridges serve in connecting the cities and towns in and around Waterloo Region. But I also think of the many low-tech bridges I've crossed in my life, like a tree fallen in the woods I played in as a kid, or the swinging bridge in Souris, Manitoba that I used to nervously walk over when I visited there with my grandparents. Who thought allowing bridges to swing was a good thing? Or some of the very intimidating so-called bridges that Aaron Holmes led me and 50 high school students across during walks through the Andes and the Costa Rican forest during outreach trips. That's me with a burgundy hoodie tied around my waist, confidently crossing one of the more stable bridges. Or not so confidently, I guess. I remember when Todd and I were dating, we went biking through a forest near UW campus, and we came to a small, shallow creek. Someone had placed a narrow piece of wood across it to allow people to get across it without getting wet. Todd confidently rode his bike across that plank of wood, but I was not having any of it. I spent the next several minutes assessing the shallowest, narrowest section of the creek and did my best to carry my bike across the creek without getting too wet. I was not entirely successful. Had I been willing to use that bridge, not only would I have stayed dry, my trip would have been easier, which is what having a bridge is all about, really. And perhaps that is what Jennings is getting at when he calls us to this spectacular joining, being willing to serve as a bridge. So what does that look like exactly, this spectacular joining, this call for followers of Jesus to become a bridge? Well, if we take Jennings' lead that the storytellers, the poets, the artists, and the musicians help us understand how to affect change in the world, then I'm left thinking of one of my favorite bands, Simon and Garfunkel, and their classic Bridge Over Troubled Water. I think there may be some wisdom in those lyrics that could serve as a call to action of sorts, so I will close with those. When you're weary, feeling small, when tears are in your eyes, I'll dry them all. I'm on your side when times get rough and friends just can't be found. Like a bridge over troubled water, I will lay me down. When you're down and out, when you're on the street, when evening falls so hard, I will comfort you. I'll take your part when darkness comes and pain is all around. Like a bridge over troubled water, I will lay me down.